It seems like a long time since politicians were telling us that when it came to the pandemic, we were all in it together. Some of the first outbreaks were among wealthier people who had been overseas on holiday, bringing the virus back to rich areas in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne and Sydney. But very quickly the focus and the suffering shifted suburbs, primarily to the north and west in Melbourne and to the western suburbs in Sydney. In the third wave, almost one in every five cases in Sydney occurred in the Canterbury Bankstown Local Government Area, or LGA, followed by Cumberland, Blacktown and Liverpool. In Melbourne in the same period, almost one in every five cases were recorded in Hume, with high case numbers in Whittlesea, Wyndham and Casey, which is in the southeast. To put it simply, class was and continues to be the key factor in whether you catch COVID and how likely you are to die. Many of us have thought that from watching developments. Now researchers have brought out a new report, Unlucky in a Lucky Country, How COVID Has Exposed Social Inequity, that gives us the figures that prove the point. Today my guest is Dr. Tom Barnes. Tom is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Humanities and Social Sciences at the Australian Catholic University and the lead author of the report. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity. We're a revolutionary socialist group in Australia, and if you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Naam, or Melbourne. So Tom, welcome.
Thanks, David.
So first up, why did you think it was important to map the impact of COVID in Australia? And did any of the results surprise you?
Well, the immediate catalyst for the research was that I was asked to do a report for an organisation called Catholic Health Australia. And they were interested in the social and the economic inequality which underpinned the COVID pandemic. But also, I mean, as a researcher, I've very much been interested in inequality vis-a-vis work, particularly insecure work and precarious work and its impact on workers and labour movements. So I sort of brought those interests and those research skills, I suppose, to this project. And that report, as you mentioned, has just come out. I think what the research found really confirms a lot of personal experiences from the pandemic and also experiences from people that many of us know, in terms of the inequalities and the experiences of the pandemic, in terms of the fact that the pandemic had a greater impact on people's lives in certain areas, more so than other areas, and in terms of the differential impact on the rich and poor. So what I did with this research was to effectively crunch the numbers, if you like, to look at data from different state-based health authorities. So in Melbourne, looking at Vic Health data, and then New South Wales Health for Sydney, and also looking at economic and social data from agencies like the Australian Bureau of Statistics and others, and essentially computing all of that data into an economic model, which is basically a fancy way of trying to prove cause and effect between different factors, different variables. And lo and behold, what we found is that the experiences of the pandemic were highly unequal. And in particular, we found that what underpinned the experience of the pandemic has been, you know, high levels and widening levels of class inequality. I mean, there are other kinds of inequality, like gender inequality, which the report also talks about, as well as inequality in ethnic and racial terms, which is also, you know, very important, but particularly class inequality lay at the core of it. And that data especially came from the experience during the so-called third wave, the Delta wave, which was between June, July last year and October, November, which particularly impacted on Sydney and Melbourne. Although we do draw on data from earlier waves of the pandemic. And I'm looking at the current wave, the Omicron wave, as we speak. But it looks particularly at that period in the second half of 2021, that experience of lockdowns and the unequal impacts of that, particularly in working class communities.
You talk about class. That's not very fashionable as a concept in the academic world. Can you flesh out what you mean by this? How do you define working class communities?
This report, it doesn't define class in a precise way. What we looked at in the report was occupational groups, as well as ethnic and racial groups, or proxies for ethnic and racial groups. So ethnic and racial groups are certainly not the same thing as classes, and racial oppression is something which can't be reduced to class inequality, although I think the two are closely linked. But in terms of class inequality, we look specifically at occupations, occupational groups, the types of jobs that people have, which is, you know, I would say it's a dimension of class, or a dimension of class inequality. Occupation and what you do for a job is not exactly the same thing as class. Traditionally, some class theorists have focused on occupations, whereas others, particularly Marxists, have argued that the key to class is the point of production. You know, it's the relationship between workers and capital, and very much defining membership of class based on that relationship. So, for example, looking at the working class in terms of those people who depend upon the exchange of their capacity to work in return for wage income. Whereas others might think of the working class more in terms of, you know, blue-collar occupations and things like that. So that those questions of occupation are related to class without being exactly the same thing. So I think it's important to preface this research with that insight, because this report is based on, it's especially based on the impact, the unequal impact of the pandemic in terms of occupational groups, so blue-collar occupational groups, white-collar occupational groups, and so on. So that's a central dimension of class without being exactly the same thing. You know, nevertheless, that caveat aside, I think what our report shows is that workers who lived in areas with high proportions of blue-collar work did tend to suffer the negative effects of the pandemic much more severely than people living in areas with high proportions of white-collar workers, such as managers and professionals.
And you were actually able to give almost a mathematical relationship between those two things, between the proportion of blue-collar workers in a local government area and the number of COVID infections. How robust is that?
So I mentioned before that we came up with a model, and without going into the technical details, what that model provides is a way for us to compute, you know, large amounts of data, so health-based data such as COVID-19 case numbers, and high volumes of data based on social and economic variables like income, where people, the jobs that people have, where people live, and so on. And what we came up with was a model that is able to predict the impact of occupation as well as race and ethnicity on case numbers and on things like vaccination rates. So what the model demonstrates is a direct cause and effect between the proportion of workers in blue-collar occupations in a local government area and case numbers. So, for example, in Sydney, during the Delta wave, so during the third wave last year, that 3 to 4 month lockdown period, a 1% increase in the proportion of blue-collar workers for every local government area led to an additional 848 coronavirus case numbers. For Melbourne, during the Delta wave, an additional 1% of blue-collar workers proportionally for each LGA led to an increase of 895 coronavirus case numbers. And if you look at that spatially across each city, that impact was clearly felt in less advantaged areas more than others. So in Sydney, if you take one of the so-called 12 LGAs of concern, because listeners might remember that in Sydney, the New South Wales government had a highly unequal approach to local government areas, where they imposed much more severe restrictions on some LGAs more than others. And there were 12 so-called LGAs of concern where the restrictions were much more severe. And 11 of those 12 LGAs of concern are in the western suburbs of Sydney. You mentioned Canterbury Bankstown before, which had about 1 in 20 of case numbers during the Delta wave, and also I think during the Omicron wave. If you take another example of a less advantaged Western Sydney LGA with a high proportion of working class residents, Fairfield, the city of Fairfield, the proportion of blue collar workers in Fairfield is 7 times higher than in a relatively affluent LGA like Woollahra in the eastern suburbs. Woollahra is sort of Malcolm Turnbull land, if you like, you know, high income, high wealth, one of the wealthiest parts of the country, in fact. To take an example from Melbourne, if you take a relatively working class suburb in the western suburbs, so if we look at if we look at the LGA of Brimbank in the western suburbs, the proportion of blue collar workers in Brimbank is about 4 times higher than in a relatively affluent LGA like Stonington in the eastern suburbs or the inner southeastern suburbs of Melbourne. So it's in those areas, so the western suburbs primarily of Sydney and the kind of outer suburban working class suburbs of Melbourne, where case numbers were concentrated. And my economic model demonstrates that formally. It demonstrates something which many of us have felt in our own experiences or through people we know or people we work with, that the experience of the pandemic has been much worse depending on where you live and what you do for work. And this model demonstrates that, or proves that formally, if you like. The research also shows, by the way, that in those areas with high proportion of blue-collar workers, you also tended to have the slowest rates in terms of the vaccination rollouts in 2021. So if you're able to look at the example of Hume in Melbourne, the Hume LGA in the northern suburbs of Melbourne, where you had almost 1 in 5 of case numbers occurring during the Delta wave, in Hume, even by October, November, Hume had one of the lowest rates of vaccination in Melbourne. So what the report shows is working class suburbs, high numbers of people in blue collar occupations who are much more exposed to the coronavirus because of the nature of their work. These are workers who by and large cannot or could not work from home. They could not work remotely. They had to maintain a physical presence to keep their jobs. They were more exposed, more at risk, and also tended to live in areas with lower vaccination rates. So these are the dynamics of inequality or class inequality which the research demonstrates.
And going back to your previous point that a blue-collar occupation is not necessarily a sign of working class, because blue-collar occupations also cover traders, small contractors and the like, but the one thing they all have in common is, as you say, that they can't work from home. And many of them, in fact, particularly the self-employed, will have no sick leave and therefore would have been under particular pressure to keep on working, to cut corners, to take risks. Is that how you see it too?
Yeah, so when I talk about blue-collar occupations, I'm talking specifically about occupational groups like technicians, tradies, you mentioned, and manual labourers in various industries. So I should say that the analysis also applies to other occupations where remote working generally wasn't an option, which you wouldn't necessarily describe as blue-collar traditionally. So I'm thinking here of industry sectors or industries like aged care, home care, early childhood education and care, where you had most workers had to remain on the job physically in the workplace. They couldn't work remotely to maintain their employment. Some of that detail is in this report, but I've been doing other research, mainly with trade unions, actually, which interviews a lot of workers about their experiences during the Delta wave in Western Sydney. And that focuses on workers in blue-collar occupations, as well as many workers, particularly women, working in this very large part of the economy, which we call healthcare and social assistance, which includes childcare and aged care and things like that. And again, the exposure to the coronavirus and the dangers of the coronavirus and the social and economic impacts of lockdowns were much more severe for these types of workers. So, you know, blue-collar work is important. It's a very important dimension of class. But when we talk about working class people and the unequal experience of the pandemic and lockdowns, we're talking about a much broader majority of people in Australia.
One of the factors that you identified as being linked to increased numbers of cases in any given LGA is the proportion of culturally and linguistically diverse residents, which I think is a way of saying people from first, second generation migrant communities, is that identical to the mapping of the impact of blue collar occupations, or did you find any differences?
So culturally and linguistically diverse is this kind of academic term which is used these days, but essentially what the report is looking at are ethnic and racial minorities, and the way that that is structured into the modelling is we look specifically at people who were born overseas who primarily speak a language other than English in their household. That's a very large proportion of a labour force. So in, say, Victoria, we'd be talking about probably a third of the workforce, something like that. So a very, very large minority of workers of the working class. And the report does show that there was a relationship between LGAs with a high proportion of migrants, of non-English speaking migrants, and coronavirus case numbers, as well as relatively low vaccination rates. So just to take an example from Sydney, so every 1% increase in the percentage of non-English speaking migrants per LGA led to an increase of 609 coronavirus case numbers during the Delta wave. The increase in Melbourne was 642. So there is a relationship between race and ethnicity and exposure and risk to coronavirus. People who come from non-English speaking backgrounds tended to be more vulnerable and more at risk and more exposed to the dangers, as well as the economic effects of the pandemic. The relationship is not as strong statistically, if you like, between race, ethnicity and coronavirus as it is between blue collar occupations, but it's still there. But the conclusion I draw from this is, I mean, I don't really look at this as separate from the class inequality dimension. I look at the racial and ethnic inequality dimensions, even though they are distinctive, I look at them as intersecting with the class inequality dimension. So it's very much, I mean, if we're looking at the LGAs like Canterbury-Bankstown or Fairfield in the western suburb of Sydney, or Hume, or, you know, Brimbank or Whittlesea as working class areas in Melbourne, those areas tend to be, population-wise, dominated by working class people who are either first or second generation migrants from non-English speaking backgrounds. So that there's an overlap, a very strong overlap between race, ethnicity and class. And in fact, even, you know, irrespective of the pandemic, I think that what the research shows is that there's a kind of symbiotic or mutually reinforcing relationship between class and race. That is to say, coming from a non-English speaking background, coming from a non-white background, that sharpens the experience of class exploitation or class inequality. And being part of the working class for people from a non-English speaking background, it sharpens the experience of racial oppression and racial inequality. So there's a mutually reinforcing relationship between those two things, which I think is borne out by the report. What I try and do in the research is to show how class, using blue-collar occupations as a proxy, intersects with communities which are dominated by first and second generation migrants from non-English speaking backgrounds. And I think, again, that statistical presentation reflects many of our own experiences during the pandemic.
And of course, the other big axis of oppression is the experience of women, and your findings, or one of your findings, is that the social and economic impacts of extended lockdown policies fell disproportionately on women. Can you take us through that?
Absolutely. The impact on women has been much sharper. So if you look at some of the economic data, I mean, there's been a lot of talk in the media for quite a while about economic booms and miraculously low levels of unemployment. The fact that unemployment has stayed low and falling in many cases during successive periods or successive episodes of coronavirus outbreaks and lockdowns. But what that really masks is really a dramatic decline in total employment and also a dramatic decline in the size of the labour force. So in Sydney during the Delta wave, the total labour force declined by 8%. In and of itself is massive. Total employment between June and October declined by 7% in Sydney, which is a similar fall to the fall that was experienced after the first wave in March 2020. So it's a similar fall, which would have been catastrophic socially had it not been for things like JobKeeper and the coronavirus supplement for job seeker recipients. So, you know, very, very sharp declines in labour force participation and in total employment. that decline has been greater for women. In Sydney, we see, as I mentioned, an 8% decline in the total labour force during the Delta wave. We saw a 9% fall in the female labour force during that period. That's before we even mention the unequal impacts of lockdowns in terms of school closures and the pressures of homeschooling, as well as, I think this is particularly the case in Melbourne, where for a long period their childcare centres were closed. That the impact of that at the household level, which was borne overwhelmingly by women. I mean, the already unequal distribution of domestic work, of unpaid domestic work, falling on the backs of women, that was sharpened significantly by the experience of the lockdown. So some of that is borne out in this research. But gender inequality, I think, was definitely sharpened by successive waves of the pandemic. But again, I would come back to the intersections between that and the racial and the class dimensions, that they all work kind of hand in hand. So the experience for many women during the pandemic was worse, but it was far, far worse for those women who were working in highly exposed sectors such as home care, aged care, early childhood education and care, and for those women who were working in those working class areas such as the LGAs of concern in Western Sydney, where the restrictions were much more severe, the restrictions in terms of the testing requirements, restrictions on being able to cross LGA boundaries for work purposes. There were horror stories from August in Canterbury Bankstown with people having to wait hours 2-3 times a week just to get a PCR test so they could go to work. And often this was so-called essential work in healthcare and hospitals. So that experienced unequally by women. So the gender inequality dimension is critical to this picture.
You talked at the beginning about building a model around data, but you also talked to a whole range of welfare organisations in the Catholic sector. So you got what might be called qualitative data to go along with the quantitative data. And you found some very scary things. For instance, you report that Vinnies in New South Wales experienced a significant rise in women and children requiring domestic violence support services, with calls for assistance going up by a fifth in some periods. Can you take us through some of the experiences that you captured when you were talking to welfare organisations?
The issue of domestic violence has definitely been highly significant during the pandemic. That issue isn't a centrepiece of this report, Unlucky in a Lucky Country, but it has been an issue which I've looked at in other similar research. So I have spoken to a few different organisations who, are involved in directly assisting women and kids who are victims of domestic violence, as well as looking at kind of some secondary analysis, I suppose you'd call it, of the experience. And first of all, it does appear that the pandemic has had a pretty significant impact on both rates of domestic violence and the experience of domestic violence. So just there was a report which came out only in the last week, in fact, which suggests that 1 in 12 women who have a live-in partner experience some form of physical violence. Like 1 in 12, that's an extraordinary statistic. And that was reported during the beginning of the first wave, the beginning of the pandemic proper, if you like, in March 2020. And this isn't just some kind of radical or fringe research. This is research from a government-sponsored body, the Australian Institute of Criminology, and this is a major survey of over 15,000 women. So this is not pie in the sky. This is like an extraordinary finding of high rates of not just domestic violence, but specifically physical violence as a dimension of domestic violence. I think the other thing I've found in qualitative terms from talking to different agencies, and this is particularly in Victoria, is that there appear, even though some of the data on rates of domestic violence has been sketchy, there is a lot of qualitative evidence which would suggest that the severity of domestic violence has become worse as a consequence of the social and economic pressures of the pandemic and lockdowns. So what that would mean is that, for example, women who live in a domestic situation in which they previously experienced psychological or emotional abuse, that the perpetrator of that violence would be more likely to have shifted into more physical, overtly physical forms of violence. there's a lot of evidence coming out which suggests that there's been an increase in severity of domestic violence as a consequence of the pandemic. And in some cases, there was a direct link between those types of behaviours and experiences and the experience of lockdown. So in some cases, perpetrators of domestic violence would use lockdown rules as an added excuse to try and control their partner physically or emotionally by saying, you know, you're not allowed to leave the house, you can't escape, those types of logics. And in fact, that was a big enough problem that in the early days of the pandemic, I remember in Melbourne, the Victorian government, Dan Andrews, had to come out and under pressure from women's organisations and domestic violence organisations and say that leaving the home under lockdown for reasons of domestic violence was a legitimate reason to leave the home, as well as other mundane things like going shopping or going to work in an authorised or an essential workplace. You know, if you were experiencing family violence, you had a right to leave the home under lockdown conditions. Like many women were unaware of this. And another related problem has been finding shelter for women and kids who have experienced domestic violence. So this is always a problem, which is exacerbated by the fact that there's just a dearth of supply of public housing and social housing. You know, in places like Sydney and Melbourne, I mean, governments, both Liberal and Labor, have systematically defunded and deprioritised public and social housing for decades. And one of the consequences is this unequal experience for women who have experienced domestic violence. And this was sharpened during the pandemic, where it became much more difficult for agencies assisting women to find even temporary accommodation for women trying to flee abuse or violence. So all of these things have been made much worse by the pandemic and the lockdown. There's no question about that.
Well, the pandemic isn't over, but the higher rate of job seeker is a distant memory. JobKeeper, for all its faults, is over, and it's getting harder and harder to get government sick pay if you're a casual. So the factors of poverty and social exclusion haven't gone away, and if anything, as you say, are getting worse. So what should unions and community groups be fighting for now?
Well, I think that the overriding context for the coming period is going to be the federal election and the federal election campaign. I mean, Scott Morrison's supposed to call the federal election sometime pretty soon. So, you know, already a lot of the focus is going to be on that, on the question of whether there'll be a change of government. Quite naturally, a lot of unions who are involved in defending their members' rights in terms of COVID and the pandemic will have a strong orientation towards a change of government. And I think that's right. You know, I think it's right that is an important focus. I mean, my report, it doesn't talk about that because it's a different kind of report. But my own personal view is that the primary responsibility for the social and economic pain of a lockdown in Australia lies with the federal government. What is the main reason why Sydney and Melbourne in particular, but other places too, were forced back into extended lockdowns during the Delta wave between mid to late 2021. The reason for that is that the federal government stuffed up the vaccination rollouts. I mean, by June last year, when the Delta wave began in Sydney, Australia at that time had an embarrassingly low rate of vaccination for other similarly affluent countries. And the government had just up until that time absolutely stuffed up the process. And if they hadn't have done that, if they'd organised it properly, then it's arguable, I think likely, that we wouldn't have had to go back into lockdown. But we did. And not only did we go back into lockdown, but we went back into an extended lockdown, which did not have many of the same economic protections that existed during the outbreak in 2020. So there was no JobKeeper. There was no coronavirus supplement for JobSeeker. A lot of the other fiscal measures in place to protect jobs and livelihoods were not in place. We had these things called COVID disaster payments, which were wholly inadequate. They didn't provide workers with an incentive to stay at home if they were able to. They were not available to existing welfare recipients. If you were already receiving some type of welfare claim at the time the policy was announced, you were ineligible to receive COVID disaster payments. So the protections weren't there for people. And so it was workers, working class communities who by and large bore the brunt of the economic and social pain of the last major lockdown. So again, I think it was the federal government who are responsible for that. I mean, they shifted the burden, they shifted the risk of the pandemic onto working class communities. So, you know, that pain in terms of jobs lost, income lost, the unequal experience of migrant communities, the unequal experience of women, all of that flows from the attacks of the federal government. So I think it's right that unions and other social movements have a strong focus on getting rid of the Liberal government at the looming federal election. But I also think there are a range of related and perhaps more immediate issues that we need to fight around. So that there's a question of rapid antigen tests and the inadequate organisation that's gone into securing supply of rats. The demand for free and freely available rats is an important one, and it's important that Anthony Albanese finally agreed to support that demand, although he took his time, but he did come on board eventually. So that's important. I think that the unequal rates of the vaccination rollouts continue. So I think in those working class suburbs where you had the greatest economic pain and the greatest exposure to coronavirus case numbers during previous waves, you also had lower rates of vaccination by and large. That continues to be the case based on the latest figures around the Omicron wave. And that's a problem. I mean, there's also evidence that the federal government has again stuffed up the vaccine program, but this time for kids. So, you know, millions of parents around the country have been trying to vaccinate their kids before schools go back in the next few days. And often there are a lot of stories, far too many stories, of parents having their jab appointments cancelled for their kids because GPs and medical centres were unable to secure their deliveries of vaccine for the booster jab. So, you know, which is unforgivable given that everything that's happened in 2021, all the problems with the so-called vaccine strollouts, for them to do it again for kids prior to schools going back is just shocking, but that's happened. So I think there are important demands around fixing up the vaccination stuff up. And then perhaps one final thing I would raise is around job seeker and the importance again of raising the job seeker rate back to something which is approaching a livable income. I mean, the coronavirus supplement during 2020 effectively doubled the rate of job seeker, and that we know from talking to various social service providers, social agencies, that had a huge impact in terms of alleviating poverty, improving the lives of, you know, hundreds of thousands of welfare recipients, hundreds of thousands of workers. And yet that was promptly cut right back to a lower rate in 2021. So I think the demand for increasing the job seeker rate, the fact that we now know that the choice to keep job seeker low is a political and deliberate one. There's no need for it, that we can afford to pay unemployed job seekers a living income is an important question. So I think demands around increasing the job seeker rate will also continue to be important, alongside demands around vaccines, rapid antigen tests, as well as the overarching question of a change of government.
Thanks very much for your time today, Tom.
No problem, Dave.